Today's episode of the City of Smack podcast on the City of Smack podcast network is brought to you by Stride. Here's a problem that nearly every runner faces. We all know that even pacing is important, but it's hard to pace your runs in challenging conditions. Sometimes you're facing rolling hills, other times you're running into the wind, the heat, and the humidity can slow you down, and depending on where you are, altitude can also play a factor. All these forces are constantly causing you to change your pace when you're just trying to stay at an even consistent effort. So I got this tool that I've really been enjoying that makes even pacing possible in difficult conditions. It's called Stride. It's a super lightweight pod that sits on my shoe and talks with my Garmin watch. Essentially, it provides a grade-adjusted, wind-adjusted, heat-adjusted, humidity-adjusted, and altitude-adjusted number to my watch called Power. Instead of trying to change my pace in these conditions to keep an even effort, I can simply aim for a consistent power from start to finish by looking at my watch. Over 24 Olympic Trials marathoners will be running with Stride in Atlanta, where even pacing is going to be very difficult due to the hilly course. So if you want to learn more about Stride, go to stride.com/Sidious. That's STRYD.com/Sidious. I've really been enjoying using my Stride pod. Now it's time for you to go and check it out. My guest for today's show is Natasha Rogers. She was an NCAA champion while at Texas A&M as a junior, and then went on to finish second at the U.S. Olympic Trials in 2012. Unfortunately, sometimes there's a little bit more that goes into making the Olympics. You need to finish at the top three at the trials and also have the Olympic qualifying time or standard to ensure your spot. Natasha finished second but didn't have the qualifying time, so she wasn't able to go. It was a really tough spot to be in. And then after that, her post-collegiate career went through its ups and its downs and its ins and outs of the sport. And you're going to hear all about that in this episode. It's a very wild ride, but now she's back and just won the USATF cross-country national title. She's racing well and targeting the U.S. Olympic trials in June. Natasha opens up quite a bit here, and I appreciate her candor in talking all about those years in great detail. And I think you guys will enjoy it as well. So without further ado, here is Natasha Rogers. All right, now we welcome Natasha Rogers to the podcast. Natasha, so like, do most conversations with you start off with like, welcome back? Because I mean, it's been just like you've been in and out of the sport for the last couple years, but right now it's an Olympic year, it's 2020, and it seems safe to say you're back.
Yes, I am definitely back, and I got things on my mind. but yeah, for the most part, a lot of people know that I left and kind of just went black for a while, and it's really cool to have the support coming back.
For sure. And I guess, like, it's a tough place to start, but I guess, like, the first big race that a lot of people sort of tie into you and associate you with is, like, the 2012 trials. So to kind of, I guess, use that as the starting point, for you, that was a year where you came, well, you were still in college at the time as a junior, win the NCAA title in the 10K, and then finish second at the trials. How, I mean, that in 2012, I'm sure it was the hardest time to really process that race, because what ended up happening was you fell 14 seconds shy of hitting the standard to go to the Olympics. How hard is that race now to think about?
I mean, it's kind of just the same feelings as I had back then, but a little bit magnified now because of the fact that I have been through three Olympic cycles now, well, going into my third, and you know, this isn't a forever thing, and eventually I'll run out of my last chance, and so it really does kind of sit a little bit heavy on my mind, because it's something that I really want to do in my lifetime. And you know, once you get too old, you're too old. So I'm approaching 29, and you know, I'm just going to give it all I got this year, and whatever happens, happens. But at least I can know that I did literally everything I could to try and get there, get to Tokyo.
29 is not old in this sport.
Yes, but once you've like already lost sponsorship and then had to go work in the corporate world, you really get a good taste of the reality of it all. Like, you got to be making money, you got to be supported if you're going to do this, and the support runs dry. And yeah, it's not easy to stay in it for that long, that's for sure.
When I guess like you made your first, so you took I think a little bit of time after 2012, but in that comeback of sorts the first time around, did you find it hard to stop having to compare yourself to, you know, that 2012 season and how strong it was?
Absolutely, yeah. I will forever hold myself to that expectation, because I know I can be there and I know I've been there before. And I mean, I've had many seasons and races where I come in last place and I'm not doing well. And so it can be hard. But I've kind of learned, I'm a little bit wiser now to know that you really do have to have those rough seasons and races in order to kind of get the wheels turning and light a flame underneath your butt to start working harder. I've been last place at Millrose before, and I didn't do that well at the 5K championships. It was only my second race back in 2019 when I got sponsorship again. But as tough as those races really are, knowing where I can be, they're good reminders, and they really kind of reinvigorate you to start reaching your full potential.
The thing about some of those bad races that happen is because, like, as you know, someone who's in the media, we see, you know, first place come by, second place come by, third place come by, and that's like the people we probably end up talking to. And people, you know, who finish in that backpack end up, you know, being able to walk by. I mean, granted, it's like talking to someone after a really bad race is always rough, but yeah. How, I guess, low do you get, or did you get after some of these races?
Well, it was more of like the humiliation part of it. Just because everyone knows, like anyone who's been in this world for a while knows that I don't belong in last place and I don't belong in like coming in 19th, you know, but so I would say the embarrassment is the worst part. But for me, like, I can brush that off within a couple days and, like, get my butt in the pool and start cross training harder because you can do a lot more work in there. And that's kind of my secret weapon. So, yeah, like, I just really start dialing in on my strengths and just a new mentality, like, I don't forget those races and I hold on to them, and they actually help me get to where I need to be going.
So after the 12 trials, what happened next? Because you took a little bit of a break. Where did you go?
So I just kind of needed to figure out what it all meant to me. And I realized how serious it was getting. Like, I knew that it could be the direction my life was going, but I didn't just want to, like, you know, willingly accept that. I wanted to be sure that that's what I wanted, especially after the heartbreak of missing an Olympic team and, you know, just barely missing it. And that all just became super serious for me. And a little bit confusing at the time too, because I was still in college, and the injuries, I don't take injuries very well, like many runners. And I really, as I've mentioned a few times now, struggled with an identity crisis. And so I got injured and I took some time away from the sport. And that was pretty disappointing for mostly everyone involved. But I just had to do what was best for me. And I finished out my senior year without being a runner in college. And I got to experience being a normal college person at that time. And I also decided to study abroad in Argentina, Buenos Aires, which was really like an invaluable experience. And I wouldn't have done it any other way if I could go back. So
while you're out there, is it zero running and like a total hard cut and like disconnect?
In Argentina?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's when I started to run again. It was, you know, a different place, and enough time had passed that I was like healed. And I also was dealing with a little bit of culture shock and homesickness. So whenever I'm dealing with feelings like that, or like anxiety, or just feeling a little bit like, I don't know, trapped, maybe, like I couldn't go home because I had to finish it out down there. And I kind of gravitate towards running in those situations. My body just always, my legs just want to move when I'm feeling like that. And there was this beautiful park there. And I remember doing like my first run down there, and I just started to run every day again once I was down there, and realized that when I would get back from Argentina, that I would probably really start considering signing pro.
Who else did you talk to kind of get back onto that pro scene and like that decision?
Not many people. Just because of how I left the whole running scene. Like a lot of people were really surprised, slightly disappointed. And there was even, you know, stuff being talked about on the internet. And so I didn't really reach out or seek out a ton of guidance, which that's a mistake that I have repeated throughout my career as a runner, and something that I'm really focusing on now, as I'm approaching 29 in this running scene, and that's a lesson that I really had to learn. I usually base all my decisions off of intuition, which I really trust my intuition. And that's what I did back then. I just reached out to Ray. He was one of the many agents that was leaving me messages at the time. And for some reason, I just thought Ray would be the right choice. And I'm glad I did, because him and I have a really solid relationship.
So you decided to give it a shot again in 2014. You sign with New Balance. You work with Coach Mark Coogan, who, like, just this past weekend at Milrose, I mean, we see his work with Eleanor Puryear paying off, and she has this tremendous breakthrough, breaks the American record, 4:16 for the mile. What did you learn, I guess, under his training philosophy?
So that was a really tough transition for me for many reasons, and it wasn't just like because of one sole reason. When I called Ray, and he was like, okay, New Balance wants you, but you have to move to Hanover, New Hampshire. And I didn't even know, like, I forgot New Hampshire was a state. And, like, it was just a huge move for me to do just for running. And he had mentioned Mark Coogan and that he was Abby DiAgostino's coach. And, like, I even had a boyfriend at the time when I was still living at Texas. And I felt like in order to do the running thing, I had to do whatever anyone else told me to do, like when it came to sponsorship. And I didn't really feel like I had a say in, like, oh, maybe moving to New Hampshire is not the best thing for me right now. And it wasn't. And I had to move there. It's a very small town. It's a college town. Where Dartmouth is. And really, we were waiting for Abby to graduate so that she could be the second person on the team, because I was the first person on that very new team that they were forming. So not a lot of things were established yet for that team. And I got to go through all the rough patches, and it was brutal. I did not have an easy transition. I got injury after injury, because after coming off of, you know, quitting running and then signing pro and then getting thrown into Abby DiAgostino's workouts, that equation equals injury. And so I couldn't even really run after I had moved my whole life to the Northeast Coast. Didn't have any friends in New Hampshire, and it was not easy. We eventually moved to Boston once Abby graduated, and things got easier when I had her kind of going through it with me. But we also, like, she got injured too, and it was pretty typical for, you know, college girls going to the pro league. It's really not easy for anybody, but I think I had it pretty bad.
And how did that mentality shift where you start to focus your attention on the 16 trials? And was it something like just all in on considering it like redemption for 12?
Well, after like that crazy transition and just being injured over and over again, we're talking like 4 stress fractures in 1 year. I had to move my life out of Boston, and I had to have that tough conversation with New Balance and just say, guys, I need to try something different here. So I actually moved the year before, or actually only like 6 or 7 or 8 months before the 2016 trials. So I really wasn't in a position to reclaim what I really wanted at the 2016 trials. And I did try, but it just wasn't there yet. You gotta have your stars aligned in order to place top 3 at the trials.
And so after, did you, what happens after the 16 trials?
So after the 16 trials, my contract was coming to a close, and I knew it would be renegotiated for the 2017 year, which it was. But, you know, if you're not performing in this world, you're not going to be getting as much support. And so once 2017 rolled around, me and Ray kind of had a serious talk, and he's like, you know, there's a ton of money to be made on the roads. And I was like, all right, tell me about it. And my whole 2017 year was focused on making as much money as I possibly could on the roads, which I had a very, very successful year. And the money was good. And I was on a roll. I won a national title in the half marathon and first American at Boulder Boulder, while still being competitive on the track and placing fifth at outdoors. Just two places, or actually, I don't even think Shalane went. So I was one place away from making the world team that year.
So when something like that happens, and I'm thinking like 12, and then like all so world championship year that year. Do you find it within yourself to still watch those races on the world scene?
I didn't used to because I was just kind of like a brat. I don't know. I didn't used to. And now I like when I'm bored at night in my room, instead of like turning on Netflix, I'll turn on like some old world championship races or some diamond leagues, or I definitely really have gotten into studying the best of the best and getting in that mindset that I need to know how these girls run so that I can be there someday. And I just love watching those now. I watch USATF TV a lot when I'll be watching indoor nationals here. I really wanted to make it there, but it's not really like my specialty. So I'll be watching though, studying how these girls run.
When you're taking notes and like learning more about like your competitors, how do you combine that and how has it changed sort of your own racing tactics? Because you mentioned earlier, a lot of the decisions, whether it's in your life, have been made on like intuition. And is that very similar to how you race too? Because I mean, there comes a time within these races where as a professional, you have to know when you're going to make your big move. And how has that changed as you're learning more and as you're like, I guess, coming back into things?
I really like that question. The answer is yes. I race with my heart, not really with my brain. And sometimes I can't even control my legs. Like, it's like, oh, I'm just sprinting to the front now. And this might kill me later, but I truly am a racehorse. And yeah, I would say that studying these other runners and getting to know them, and I think running with them in a race is very intimate, actually. Like, you're up there, you're working really hard together, you're pushing your body to limits with another person, and you're breathing in unison. And I really feel like I get to know a lot of these runners, even though I don't like personally know them all that well. But like, even in the race, you can kind of sense what they're going to do, and you can sense where their energy levels are at, or if they're going to fade off and die. So I am going to try to be a little bit more intelligent with the way I race going into the trials, because I have to be. Like, I can't just depend on luck or my body's ability to do whatever it feels like. I gotta be smarter.
One thing that I picked up on when I taped a podcast with Mary Kane last December was, this is right after she ran Club Cross, and she was, you know, putting in these pretty good workouts, and she has a disappointing finish by her standards at the Club Cross Country Championships. And what she told me after the race was that she, you know, might be there physically, but mentally coming back into things has been a challenge. Have you found that over time to also be the case?
Let's see. For me, it's almost like the opposite. Like, I can be there mentally, but a lot of times not physically. I'm never the fittest girl, and I don't have the mileage. I don't have the consistency. I let myself take off days quite often. And I would say that, yes, at times mentally it's been rough, but mostly for me, I struggle with having the physical side show up.
I think you mentioned that, and maybe in like the Runner's World article that came out, which was that like, yeah, you probably don't have as many workouts under your belt as some of these your competitors or some of the mileage. But does the opposite also kind of like ring true a little bit, where maybe like you didn't spend the last 8 years taxing your body as much as someone else who competed at the 2012 trials?
Yeah. Actually, that's what my coach mentioned when he was, you know, considering signing me. He said, you actually have, your legs are fresh, and a lot of these girls are just barely hanging on because they just run so much. And I didn't really think of it that way until he said that. And that's something I need to continue to remind myself of, is that, yeah, I might have that over them, is a little bit of freshness.
Right. So it's like you might be turning 29 soon, but it's like your body might still be 26.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. God, I feel old, let me tell you.
In 2018, I mean, you're back on the road racing circuit. You qualified for the World Half Championships, and then like the flu knocks you out. And in an attempt to try and rush back, you hurt your knee. How bad was that knee injury?
Really, really terrible. Knees are the worst pain. I've had, like I said, I've had 4 stress fractures in 1 year. Nothing compares to the knee. And the knee heals on its own terms, too. Whereas a stress fracture, you're out for 6 weeks. And then, you know, you follow the regimen. But with a knee, there's no telling what's even wrong with it. There's no telling when it's going to start feeling better. And that's where the depression came in, because I'm already not good at being injured. But to have all these unknowns up in the air was killing me. And so basically, nothing too serious initially. I blew out my knee somehow. And then what people were saying, even though I never really got an official diagnosis, was that it wasn't tracking along its groove. So, you know, it took about 4 or 5 months to be able to start running again. I had to withdraw from the World Half Marathon Championships. And I remember I even got a side job just because I didn't like how much free time I had, because I was still sponsored, but I couldn't run and I couldn't even do anything in the pool or the bike. So
what was the side job?
Probably the worst one I could have chosen, but I got a job at this little pizza place just like 4 or 5 hours out of the day, which I probably shouldn't have done that, but I felt like I was going crazy. Like I needed something to do in the day while everyone else was at work, because I couldn't do anything with my knee. But that didn't last long, because I realized like being on my feet wasn't helping either. And so the summer came around in 2018 and I was able to run again, started running an hour a day. And I even put a race on the schedule. I was like planning on doing the 5K champs, later that fall, but like many pro runners, I looked into PRP as, something that could kind of accelerate and help things like along further. And it backfired on me, because I, going back to needing to seek out the right guidance for things, I did not do that at the time, and I really was alone. I wasn't hearing from anybody. Everyone kind of just brushed me to the side and forgot about me that year because I wasn't competing. And I just really want to advise people against going on Google and just picking whoever to do whatever with your body, because that was the biggest mistake I've ever made in my whole life and the only regret I have in my entire life. So after that procedure, there were things done that aren't traditionally done in a PRP procedure, including prolotherapy and scraping with the needle along both kneecaps. And granted, I had a healthy knee, but he decided to do both. And I couldn't walk for around 4 months after that. Like I could walk, but it was with severe pain. And I felt like a 100-year-old lady with arthritis in her knee. It was awful. But I managed to get through it.
You couldn't cross train or anything, right?
No, absolutely not. I couldn't even, like, laying in bed hurt at night because of what the prolotherapy does to basically your cells. It's a huge irritant. And there's very limited research on this. And, you know, it's one of those, in my opinion, it's one of those fad, like, things that kind of act on desperate people. And, I couldn't do anything, really. It was depressing.
What was the first thing you could do after that? Like, because everyone talks about kind of when they're coming back from injury, whether, you know, it's like an Achilles injury or something like that. It's just kind of like starting from scratch feels like you're so behind, where you're on a treadmill and all you can do is, you know, 1 minute of running, 1 minute of walking or something like to that extent. That seems like when the pain is that severe, that seems so distant.
Oh, yeah. I had to accept that I wouldn't be able to run again. Because I didn't know, but it really felt like there was so much damage in my knees that it was a long lost dream. And I had to accept that. And that's kind of the process of healing, is being able to accept your fate and not try to keep straining and, you know, wanting something that's not there anymore. Like, it's definitely the first and most necessary step of healing your body, is accepting it.
So how do you end up in Thailand after that?
So after the procedure, there were 2 or 3 months where things were just getting worse and worse mentally for me. Like, I knew I was going to lose sponsorship. And I knew I was going to have to get some new job. And at 27 years old, and I had no idea what that would be. I was completely directionless. And, on top of that, my boyfriend and I, our relationship was not healthy, and he broke up with me, which was a good thing. And after we're back together now, by the way, but once he broke up with me, I really didn't have anything else to lose. And it really was necessary, because that just made me realize, like, okay, like, I'm in a miserable place and I need to go just live my life solely for myself and do what I need to do. And Thailand was a part of that. I went for basically the whole month of December with the intentions that I would come back and start applying to as many jobs as possible in January and get a job in the workforce. I went for a whole month, and it was beautiful. And there was so much personal growth there and healing as well.
In the Runner's World article, you mentioned some sort of like bonfire conversation that really, I guess, like helped in that process. What was, I guess, could you share, I guess, what was said there and stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's this island off of Thailand called, they call it, it's spelled Phi-Phi Islands, but they call it Phi-Phi Islands. And, it's such a special place. That's where they filmed The Beach, if you've ever seen that movie with Leonardo. But I went over to that island, and it was such a magical place. Like, people from all over the world, like, beautiful people, like, is just everyone basically doing the same thing that I was doing, just kind of escaping and getting perspective on the world and partying on the beach. So basically that night, I went to this bonfire on the beach, and there was also these, like, they're really into like fire there. They were jump roping these ropes of fire. And so everyone was just having a really great time. And I decided to start heading back to my Airbnb, and there was this huge group, and they kind of like called me over to come sit with them. I was like walking back solo, and I went over to sit with them, and I think they were from South America, and they were just asking me like, what are you doing here? What's going on? And, I started talking with them, and I don't know what compelled me. I think it was just because they were so interested in me. And like, I just told them like that I was depressed. And that's kind of the reason why I went there. And they, like, it was just the most comforting and consoling conversation that I had in like a year. And I couldn't think of like a better group of people to actually finally admit that I was depressed, and they could relate to me. And I remember someone saying like, there's nothing to be depressed about. Open your eyes, like, look around. There's so much to the world. Like, just let it go. Just let it go. And that really, really stuck with me. And, honestly, when I got back from Thailand, I was no longer depressed. Like, I had let it go, and I was ready to move on. And that's exactly what I did. I started applying. I got through 3 rounds of interviews with Oracle. And then I didn't end up getting that job, but I ended up getting a really good job with another tech company called Conga. And it was in sales, and I was really proud of myself. I was like, I can't believe that I've made this turnaround, and people are giving me a chance to prove myself with a different identity, really. And it was absolutely what I had to do, because I needed to start making money.
So that's a totally big identity shift. When, say, hypothetically, you were looking at yourself like in the mirror on the way to work, right? It's different because you're dressing up to go into an office instead of, you know, just going out for a run. And how did that feel? Because I mean, like, in the back of, you know, in that mirror, maybe you're able to see a pair of running shoes or something that are just laying around in your room. Or was it just a total disconnect?
So when I was getting that job, that had to be my sole focus. Like, I had to go into those interviews and say, yes, running is the only thing on my resume, but I can translate that into this sales world. And it really had to be like, I had to convince my bosses that running was behind me. Because with, you know, Olympic trials, silver medalists on my resume, they're like, okay, what's going on here? Like, and I really had to convince them that I was ready to like move on. And so I was in that mentality. But then once I started working, just such a different lifestyle. I have so much respect for people who work full-time jobs and still try to be competitive in the running world, because I couldn't. I was exhausted and stressed, and I did, like, after about 2 or 3 weeks into the job, I attempted my first run again. And this was, I believe, February, when I finally got like a little run in, and it was painful still, but I was able to do it and work through it. And that's when I was like, okay, maybe I can like run on the side of my job. And I don't know, the wheels started turning after that.
What was the run? Was it just like 15 minutes, 20 minutes?
The first one I did was like a broken up 10 minutes, I think. And I didn't want to push it. And I just wanted to be happy with the fact that I could go for longer than 30 seconds without being in excruciating pain. And then like the second one, I did like a full 30 minutes. And just very, very slow. And I was still really working through a lot of scar tissue at that time. So it wasn't anything elite, that's for sure. And this was at the beginning of 2019. So where I'm at today is just, it's kind of a miracle.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that a year ago you were still working this tech sales job.
Well, yeah, all the way up until July of last year.
So the running dream has never really been over for you. I mean, I guess people talk about like Olympic dreams, and just like that phrase gets thrown around a lot. But how often do you dream about like something running related, whether it's like winning a race or making an Olympic team?
Obsessively, yeah. Once I'm like, you know, on a roll, it's everything to me. It's written. You can't even, like, if you look at my mirror, you can hardly see yourself in it because I have so much writing on it that relates to races and running and mantras. And that's how all my mirrors are in my house. So it's a little obsessive. I do have... and this isn't my OCD, but I do have like a little bit of OCD. So I try to find it as a blessing instead of a curse, even though it can absolutely be a curse if you let it get out of control. But if you are aware of it and you have control over it, it can be beneficial.
What are some of the most recent things you've written on your mirror?
So basically, after every race, I erase it all and start over because I think it's important to reset. And right now, what I have is, well, win 15K champs, which is my next race. Top three Olympic trials. That never goes away. That's always up there. Mind over matter. I wrote this one yesterday, dial back slightly, because I get in the habit of pushing way too hard. Present, and don't lose sight of what you're doing this for. And I really like that one because with things like social media, like, you know, all these interviews I've been doing lately, you can kind of lose sight of what you're actually doing this for. And like, I don't really care about any of it except for being in that race and doing this because of my love for running. I don't want it to be about the money. I don't want it to be about followers or like, you know, anything superficial like that.
So with this entire like refreshed mentality that you have on the sport, say Natasha Rogers 2020 runs into Natasha Rogers 2012 right after, you know, the trials, what would you say to her as she's coming out of like that mix zone area and, you know, finished second, but ultimately not headed to London?
That's a good question. I would probably tell her Oh, you kind of stumped me there.
No worries. Take your time with it.
Man, I don't, there's so much. I would probably tell her to stay on her own journey because, you know, after the 2012 trials, I felt like I was losing myself a little bit. And I felt sad. And I think a part of that was because my life was getting yanked in directions that I felt like I didn't really have control over anymore. So I would tell her to just stay on her own path. And I think I did a pretty good job of that, but with the exception of letting it all affect me a little too much mentally.
And that path has obviously had its ups and its downs. But I mean, like, in a way, you wouldn't really, with those ups and downs, like, you wouldn't change it?
No, because I think the downs, like, it's kind of like a roller coaster. The further you go down, the higher you're going to go up, the more momentum, you know. And I really value those low places. And it's hard to tell someone who's going through those deep, dark, low places that it's all going to be worth it. And it's just so true, though. Like, I'm here today because of how much pain I felt back then. And, you know, one thing doesn't exist without the other. That's just physics. Like, with a negative, there's a positive. And it's all a part of the big picture.
When you cross the finish line at the cross country champs just last month, I mean, like, how much of it was just a sense of relief that, I mean, in a way, you are back to that upper echelon of the sport?
Yeah, it was kind of just seeing something that you visualize over and over again actually happen. Because I remember in 2018 when I was depressed and I didn't think I could ever run again, I remember still allowing myself to, like, or, like, not even, like, able to control myself, visualizing breaking the tape again and just taking one moment to, like, soak it in. And so it was kind of like actually seeing something that you visualize over and over again come true and live it. And I know that I still have so much work to do because the big names were not in that race. And I'm not naive. I know that, like, there's huge leaps that I have to make in order to be where I actually want to go. But that was a really good stepping stone. And it's cool because of that race, people are taking me seriously again, and people are wanting to help me share my story to hopefully inspire other people.
Yeah. Awesome. Natasha, I'm going to hit you with the final questions I ask every guest. So cool. First one, what's the meanest thing you've read about yourself on letsrun.com?
Oh my God. I hate to admit that I've actually read that stuff. probably that I'm like a pubescent child, or I think someone wrote that about me one time. And it was like, I mean, okay, like, I guess, like, I can see what they're talking about there, but it's just, I'm a 29-year-old woman almost, like, I don't need to be reading comments like that about my body.
Oh, totally. Stay away from any body comments on there.
Yeah.
Next one is, what is the funniest drug testing story you have?
Oh, God. I was drug tested so much in 2017. It was like they were stalking me. Like, because I was making a ton of money on the roads and at championships. So they live an hour away. And so they would just ring my doorbell 5 a.m. all the time. And I lived in this Wash Park mansion with like three other girls. We were like splitting the rent there, and they were not runners. So they had to continuously deal with this, like, you know, drug testing stalker. And one morning I wasn't sleeping there. I was sleeping at my boyfriend's apartment, but they rang my doorbell at like 5 a.m. in Wash Park and then realized that I wasn't there. So then they somehow tracked where my parents lived, knocked on their door. Then they were like, oh, she's at Peter's house. And so they started calling me like, you better pick up. Like, then they gave the address to my boyfriend's apartment. And then they finally found me. And they not only made me pee, but they drew blood in my boyfriend's apartment with his roommate there. And his roommate was like, what the heck is going on? It was, yeah,
that's crazy. At least it wasn't like a whereabouts failure.
I know that. And that's the scary thing, is it could completely just not even be your fault. And then you get like a whereabouts failure.
Right. If you could go on a run anywhere in the world with anyone from history, they don't have to be a runner, assuming they could hold a nice little conversational pace with you, where would this run take place and who would it be with?
Oh, wow. Okay. So the run would be probably, I kind of want to go on a run in Japan with one of the Dababa sisters, or I've always kind of just wanted to like go on a run with Jordan Hesse, because I'm like a fangirl, but yeah, either one of those two, I would say.
You've raced Hesse quite a bit of times, right?
Yeah, I've beaten her before. but she, like, when she was really good, I like wasn't when I was younger. Like, I remember freshman year of college, my coach, like, this was a really special moment for me, because she would come to like our indoor track at Texas A&M, and I wasn't good. I was a nobody at the time. And me and this other girl, we would like get all excited, like, oh my God, it's Jordan Hesse. And my coach heard us doing that, and he comes up to me, puts his hand on my shoulder, and he's like, Rogers, you're going to beat Jordan Hesse someday. And I was like, are you crazy? And then I ended up making it happen. But I guess from a young age, I've just kind of been a fangirl for her, I guess. I don't know.
She listens to this podcast, so maybe we can make it happen after that.
Awesome.
And the last one has nothing to do with running. It's more of an assessment of kind of like how big of a risk taker you are. You get 25 basketball shots from half court. If you make one, you win $25 million. If you don't make any, you go to jail for 25 years. Would you attempt the shots?
Oh, my God. That's a funny question. No, I would not. No, I'm not a basketball player. And
Smart
I
move.
Would miss and go to jail.
That's a smart move. All right. Well, oh, wait, actually, one more thing, Natasha. So on February 28th, I'm hosting a live podcast in Atlanta, interviewing Keith and Kevin Hansen. Is there a funny story or one question I should totally ask them while I'm down there?
Oh, I'm excited for that podcast. Let's see, a funny story. Dang it. I really, cause I haven't been able to like spend as much time with them as I want. I'm going to go do a training stint with them in Florida, for the first half of March. But, I don't know. I'm going to have to say, I don't know for that question yet. Cause I haven't really experienced a funny situation yet. So sorry, that's a lame answer.
No, it's all good. I'll pull something out of the blue, I'm sure. Natasha, thanks so much for taking the time and for sharing kind of that overview of what a roller coaster of the last like 8 years that you've had. But I'm sure a lot of people will come away with it, with lots of, I guess, great insight and appreciation for everything that you've gone through. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be a part of this podcast.
That's all from me for this episode of the show. Thanks to Natasha for a really open conversation and for taking the time to chat. If you listened to this episode and enjoyed it, give us a shout out on your Instagram stories. We'll repost it to all our followers, and it helps new people discover the show. Many thanks to Stride for sponsoring the show. They're helping ensure that you nail the perfect pacing strategy so you can keep a consistent effort in challenging conditions all in real time. I'm digging all the data that it's collecting, and you'll see a bunch of people wearing them on their shoes at the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials. Learn more by visiting stride.com/Sidious. That's STRYD.com/Sidious. I've been your host, Chris Chavez, wishing you some happy and healthy running. And never forget, legs are feeling good.